You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show with your host, Brian Callen.
Ladies and gentlemen, another episode of Mixed Mental Arts. Hunter Motz, fresh off the Joe Rogan podcast. I am fresh off the Joe Rogan podcast. We had a great time. And I listened to the podcast, and I thought it was a lot of my friends are like, that guy articulated all the thoughts I've been thinking about for the longest time. They've been swimming around in my head. And so much of what we were talking about is trying to, I mean, you're pretty ambitious. You want to create an academic reformation here. More specifically, you want to take bros, guys who think that ideas and deep concepts maybe aren't for them. Maybe that's just, that's for academics. It's a little bit like when a scientist starts talking and I feel like I have nothing to add. Well, maybe, but it doesn't mean I can't understand it. It doesn't mean that I can't grasp the larger concepts, the important concepts, and be on a level playing field, right?
Well, I think the interesting thing is, and in terms of, you know, a lot of people who appreciated it, and not everybody did, mm-hmm. some people focused on what I was saying, and some people focused on my various verbal tics, like right, you know, all that sort of stuff, yeah. right? Which we all know about.
Well, they got mad at the minute that you started attacking one of their sacred cows.
Well, that's right.
Which was Sam Harris.
That's right.
So that's probably where the controversy happened in the last half hour.
But what it does is, I mean, and that's what we're going to do here, is we're going to create the controversy to teach the controversy. Somebody reached out to me on Twitter and said, you know, Mixed Mental Arts would be so great if Hunter wasn't on it. He needs more salt. And so,
what do you mean he needs more salt?
He needs more salt. He needs to be saltier. He needs to be more controversial. He needs to be more playful. He needs to create more trouble. He needs to be naughtier. In short, he needs to be more of the trickster character, which is what you are. You're mischievous. Yeah. You're naughty. And I think this is a great opportunity to connect the dots. And I just want to say to that person who is Ben, and his Twitter handle is @worldpeace, that he is right. And we talked about that. And he said, bring the Mortons. And so I'm going to bring the Morton salt. I'm going to give Ben all the salt that he wants.
Right.
And I'm just going to keep evolving and getting better and better and better at what I do.
Well, it's important to keep this in mind, because one of the things that you said to me as I was throwing the ball with my very strong, almost major league arm to my working line German Shepherd, who will learn how to bite an enemy's throat out. You said, look, this is something that is evolving in my own brain. Mm-hmm. I'm figuring this out. You are figuring this out. And we are trying to figure out the best way to become wise.
Mm-hmm.
What is wise?
And that's a great question. So
everybody should know that Hunter is engaged in the verb called wisdom and trying to attain wisdom.
That's right. The path to wisdom, which is crucially, it's a journey. It's not a destination.
Well, so somebody once described wisdom as sort of coming to terms with your own limitations and learning what to do with them.
Well, the wisdom lies in knowing the difference. So there are all these things like teasing or, you know, being kind or compassionate. And the question is knowing when to do each one. So, you know, should you tease somebody who has no social power, somebody who is weak? Should you make fun of the people who are weak? No, that's not wise because you are abusing your social power. But should the strong be teased by the weak to keep their egos in check? Yes, they should.
Yeah.
And that's, in fact, what happens.
As long as the teasing is fair, too. The problem with sometimes with teasing is it gets in the way of civility and then the free flow of ideas. So because sometimes what happens is, you know, the strong have a lot of times, you know, let's just take for argument's case, you know, they've spent a lot of time formulating an intelligent point of view. Sam Harris has a very intelligent point of view. There may be issues with, you know, his inability to see how his own feelings affect his point of view, which we all have. But I do think that someone like Sam Harris is worthy of the respect that he's put in a great deal of effort to come up with a strong and constructive and productive point of view that lends itself in a positive way to the larger discussion, right?
Respect, I think, people is given like that, when respect is earned, I believe, is one of these old wise sayings.
Yeah.
Now let me ask you this.
Yeah.
Does Sam Harris respect a fundamentalist imam from Islam?
I haven't spoken to him about that, so I don't want to put words in his mouth.
But I think he doesn't.
Well, my feeling is it doesn't seem that he does. And my issue with Dawkins, my issue with Harris, is that everything is reduced to its mathematical biology. I think that they're so literal.
But let's just look. You've used this word intelligent, yeah. right? Now words, you know, what words have meanings. And so the question is, what is the meaning of the word intelligent? Because if you look at the root, if you looked at how the Romans used it,
yeah.
it's interlegere, which is to choose between, the wisdom to know the difference.
Right.
So the word used to mean something, which was about wisdom. But what it's become about is the ability to quote dogma. And if you look, a Muslim cleric has a lot of intelligence by our modern definition. You will find that Muslim clerics have an encyclopedic knowledge of the Quran. Yep. Nobody has the
Catholic priests have an encyclopedic knowledge
that's
of philosophy.
Right. Exactly.
Of the other side of faith.
That's right.
They have a deep, deep understanding about and the intellectual tradition of the church runs deep.
But the big difference between a fundamentalist Muslim imam mm-hmm. and someone like my dad's boss, right, who is a Muslim scholar and, you know, also an engineer and all of these sorts of things, is that he has humility. He has the spirit of Islam. Mm. And he's coming from a totally different emotional place. And what he always said, which was one of the things that I took from him and that has been having ideas sex in my brain for a long time, is that it takes 3 seconds to become a fundamentalist, or he says a Salafi, and it takes a lifetime to become a Muslim.
Yeah.
So he's drawn this distinction between instant feeling like you know it all, arrogance.
Saul becomes Paul. There's the instant conversion when you see God. You hear about this all the time. The Holy Ghost came into me, and mm-hmm. now I am saved, and now I am a Christian. And then there's the practice.
The lifelong journey to, so he has basically what is the experience of Saul becoming Paul? It's the experience of the scale falling from his eyes, mm-hmm. where suddenly his arrogance is shattered.
Yeah.
And he achieves humility. Mm-hmm. And when he achieves that humility, then he goes on a long journey. There are lots of Sauls becoming Pauls. One of my other favorite ones is John Newton. So John Newton was a young man who was never very much into God or religion or anything like that. And he was pressed into service by the Royal Navy against his will. And then after that ended up becoming a slaver in Africa. Mm. And then at some point his ship was in a storm off County Donegal, and in that storm it looked like he was going to die, and in his desperation, in his feelings of helplessness, he cried out to God. And as a result of that, he became a Christian. This man who had no God because of the horror, and he realized the horrors of slavery. And he started following a slow hunch. And as he followed that slow hunch, he eventually came to write a song that we all know very well, which is Amazing Grace.
He wrote that song?
Yeah.
Holy shit.
And that's because he was a Saul who became a Paul.
Damn.
His arrogance was shattered, and he achieved humility. And
it's
then
funny, because when I think of Amazing Grace, I think of a black person singing it at a black person's funeral, I even think of a black person, a slave in a field, singing it as he's tilling the soil or picking, you know, cotton or something.
Well,
for someone else.
I'm not a John Newton musicology expert, but it wouldn't surprise me, based on everything we know on this podcast, if he picked up some influences, maybe without him even realizing it.
Yeah, from the Negro spirituals, mm-hmm. from the African songs.
That's right.
In the slave ships, etc., as they
so
were trying to keep themselves sane.
The point is, although name on the song is that of a white man, it's actually a collaboration between a slaver and some slaves, which is the strange...
John Newton.
John motherfucking
God
Newton.
God damn it. He wrote Amazing Grace.
Yeah.
And ladies and gentlemen, you learn something new every day.
But so the interesting thing is that there are these recurring characters in human history. They just keep coming up again and again. Saul becomes Paul. John Newton writes Amazing Grace. Mm. And there's a thing in the Babylonian Talmud, which I got from a friend of mine, Shai Steinberger, who is I don't know how strong his Orthodox faith is at this point, but at some point, you know, he was a modern Orthodox, which is basically that you're super into Orthodoxy, but you still use, you know, modern conveniences and embrace the modern world and all of that stuff. And for a long time, Shai was on the path to become one of the great Talmudic scholars, one of the great rabbis.
Wow.
And then he had a loss of faith. At Harvard, he had a loss of faith. He lost the great certainty that came from his pursuit of the Talmud. But he still has that encyclopedic knowledge, and so he shares things with me. He and I have had a lifelong friendship since college. We gravitated to each other for some weird reason that we can't even quite explain. And even though we came from these two different worlds, there was this respect between us. And we tease each other. He calls me Bunny, and I call him Scheider Reuter, and there are nicknames. And so that's...
He calls you Bunny?
Bunny.
Well, that's very gay.
It is incredibly gay. Really? Anybody observing our relationship?
Bunny and Scheider Ruger? Scheider Ruger?
Yeah, Scheider Reuter.
Scheider Reuter.
Or Scheider Ruzel.
And Bunny.
It's literally, but that's the thing. We had to create.
The guy called me Bunny. It better be well, sucking
but
my guy.
It's even worse, Brian, because why does he call me Bunny?
Well, because he has sex with you and he and you are his bottom. That's the only reason. That's literally the only reason. Any man who calls me Bunny is definitely taking me from behind. And otherwise, you're not calling me Bunny. So.
But in terms of in terms of like dumb things that I've done along my life, like there have been a lot of failed projects leading up to this moment, as I'm sure that you've had many
I've
failed
had way
women.
More. Somebody said, how'd you get so successful, man? You're on two TV shows and stand. I failed for a good 20 years. Yeah. That's how,
And I think it's worth, because, you know, part of what I've been doing on the blog is I've been using the nickname for myself of Toto. Because Toto is a trickster character. And what Toto does is he pulls the curtain back on the Wizard of Oz so that you can see there is no wizard. There's only a man pulling some levers. And what my friend Ben at World Peace is asking, he's asking me to be more the trickster.
More Toto.
Be more Toto.
Yeah.
So I'm going to be more Toto, but I'm not just going to pull back the curtain on other people. I'm going to pull back the curtain on myself. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about some of the shitty ideas that I've had along the way.
Awesome.
Okay. So firstly, there was at some point I got really into the idea that, you know, it would be awesome if I combined whey protein powder and coffee. Because I was like, this is so efficient. Like, this is literally the most efficient thing. I'm going to get so much protein and I'm going to get caffeine. It's going to be brilliant. And so for a while, when I first moved out here, when I was living with Scheider Reuter, I would do this, and I would inflict this on people. I inflicted this on Katie O'Brien repeatedly, and she was polite.
So you would make you put whey protein in, and
chocolate whey protein from
Trader
Joe's,
and you'd strain coffee into it.
Yeah, I'd put coffee into it.
It's not bad.
Well, that wasn't what Katie O'Brien thought. She thought it was disgusting, but she was polite enough. What's interesting is that for a long while, she sort of went through the motions of being like, "Oh, this is nice. I enjoy this. This is really pleasant."
She's so sweet. God bless her.
And then at a certain point, she was like, "This is fucking horrible. Like, you just need to know that this is horrible. It becomes too much. There's too much cognitive dissonance." Yeah. Or I have another collaborator that I've worked with for a long time, Mike Horton, and we have a long litany of failed screenplays. Mm-hmm. And I want to tell you about one of the worst ones that we ever came up with was that we had this idea. It was around the time that Oscar Pistorius was big, and we were like, dude, this is a brilliant screenplay idea. What we're going to do is we're going to have a movie about a runner who cuts off his own legs to win the Olympics.
Again, that's going to be tough for me. To make a sympathetic character of a guy who cuts his own legs off.
But also, like, just the raw plausibility of, like, you remove your legs and yet somehow you're better at running.
Yeah.
And there was
put on blades and
you're faster. That was the idea. And for a while, the blades seemed cool. And there was this interesting thing of people like, dude, what are the blades going to do? Are the blades going to make him faster? And then it was clear that, no, they weren't. And then Oscar Pistorius murdered shot his beautiful model girlfriend. Mm-hmm. And then at a certain point, the idea lost its emotional appeal.
Right.
But we spent literally years wrestling with what was, you know, afterwards.
Well, it's amazing how much time I've wasted writing, you know, wrong.
Yeah.
Until I learned how to write, I think at least I really started to investigate what were the books, what were the techniques that real writers engage in.
That's right.
You know, there is, again, somebody said to me, "You're not a writer."
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's for people who are of a different ilk. They're of a different chemical makeup. They're of a different a personality. And I believe that. And I stopped writing for a long time. But then I picked up a book called Story by John Truby, and I read it three times. And then I read a couple of other books. And then I gently, in my mind, very gently, began to write a screenplay. Mm-hmm. Very gently.
So you entered into the writing dojo.
I entered into the writing dojo because I thought to myself, I have an imagination.
Mm-hmm.
I just have trouble with structure. I just have trouble putting my imagination to the form that is screenwriting.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized that really good writers who I talked to, again, I would just pick their brains. I realized that there was a methodology, that there were certain ways to define character. Like character wasn't, you don't take somebody and put a bunch of attributes around them. The character and myself, you can define somebody very much on what they want. Mm-hmm. What does somebody want? What do you really want?
Mm-hmm.
And that's usually diametrically opposed to what you actually need.
Yep.
And I think the journey as we get older is to give up what we want, because usually what we want is probably things like, they're somewhat apathetic. Mm-hmm. Status, fame, recognition, sex, you know, power in general. And there's always a strange nostalgia in a human being to know that that stuff is really actually – there's usually a crisis.
Yeah.
People who really follow that Dan Bilzerian lifestyle, and one of the things he talked about on Joe Rogan's podcast, is that they're usually with somebody who thinks and mm-hmm. who feels, who's not a sociopath, there usually becomes a crisis of – you know, need in terms of this is not doing it for me. This mm-hmm. is really not. This is it's all the same thing. I know I have friends who have dated and been with the best looking women,
mm-hmm.
women that are, I mean, are the best of the best.
Right.
I'm talking about swimsuit models from Sports Illustrated and beyond. And they've had hundreds of those women. And they've had those women, I'm not kidding now, two and three at a time. I mm-hmm. know guys who've done this. And they've done it and they've chased it for 15 years. And what happens is really interesting, because typically when they do this, they'll either have some kind of a crisis.
Mm-hmm.
They'll either then really try to up the ante and get into more sensation, more drugs, more, or they'll just stop. They'll just have to turn the faucet off almost to sort of save themselves.
They hit bottom.
Because it all becomes, they can't taste it anymore. They yep. can't really, everything becomes, you become numb.
The scales fall from their eyes.
Yeah.
On the road to Damascus.
Yeah.
And that is a
form,
Paul.
That is a form of enlightenment. There is a school of thought to say that just go all the way.
Yeah.
All the way. I mean, really, really engaged in all the seven deadly sins, or at least five of them. And really do it to the end until you saturate,
mm-hmm.
until you burst at the seams and have to put yourself back together again.
Well, I don't know that you have to do that, but I think the interesting thing is that, you know, we had Jordan Peterson on.
Mm.
And one of the things, you know, we talked to Jordan for an hour, and obviously any time that you talk to anyone who has been thinking for a long time,
mm-hmm.
an hour or 3.5 hours is really, you're just opening the can of worms.
Yeah.
You're not even really scratching the surface. Mm. You know, again, it takes 3 seconds to become a fundamentalist and a lifetime to become wise.
Yeah.
But one of the cans of worms that Jordan opened at the end of the podcast is the idea of archetypes.
Yeah.
And we know from storytelling.
Prototypes, archetypes.
That's right.
Yeah.
There are these characters that recur again and again, like Saul becoming Paul, or John Newton, or, you know, whatever that quote in the Babylonian Talmud is about.
Yeah.
And the question is, why do these archetypes, why do these characters, why is it that there's a Loki, a Toto, an Anansi, you know, where Kitsune, right? Mm. Wherever you look, cultures, again and again, they have these trickster.
Explain Kitsune.
Kitsune is a Japanese fox. It's like coyote in the Native American culture. So you find that in human cultures, there are these character types that recur again and again, which is why you have Joseph Campbell's The Monomyth, which he got from Jung's archetypes. And why is it that there are these types of humans who play these certain roles in society who occur again and again? And the answer is evolution. And the reason why is because there's what's called convergent evolution in biology. So if you look at, for example, a shark, an ichthyosaur, and a porpoise, they come from three totally different lineages. So a shark is from the fish, an ichthyosaur is from reptiles, and then a porpoise is actually from mammals.
Mm-hmm.
So they start in totally different places. But the environment of the water creates this same body type. It shapes towards these same sort of solutions. And so cultural evolution does the same thing. certain environments create certain types of people because they create certain opportunities. And that's why, again and again, I've been using on the blog, there's this scene from Star Trek The Next Generation in an episode called The Drumhead. And The Drumhead is about a witch hunt. And specifically what happens is that there is this Admiral, Admiral Sati, and she is, you know, comes on the ship, and she basically starts a witch hunt. She's convinced that the Romulans are interfering. You know, there's very scanty evidence, but she's able to create a climate of fear on the ship. And is able to justify her behavior in the name of righteousness, mm-hmm. because she's trying to keep the Federation safe. And so what ends up happening is that the conflict builds and builds and builds and builds. And she keeps on basically, you know, the list of names, like McCarthy's list of names, keeps getting longer of people who are a threat mm-hmm. to the society, until eventually you get to the list of Captain Picard. And she puts Captain Picard on the stand. And what does Captain Picard do? Captain Picard creates Kintsugi. So specifically, Kintsugi is this ancient Japanese holistic art technique where when a pot breaks, rather than throwing away the broken pieces, you put the pieces together and you seal them up with gold. It's very much like yin and yang. Mm-hmm. It's that holistic mindset where you create conflict. And out of that conflict
comes something more beautiful.
That's right. And so what Captain Picard does is he quotes her father's own words at her. And specifically because her father was a great jurist, a very wise man. And this great wise man, you know, said all of these things. And he said, you know, with the first I can't remember the full quote, but it's with the first, you know, suppressed word, the chain is made, mm-hmm. right? And eventually it all damns us all. It's just this sort of...
He brings her back home.
That's right. But it creates, the crucial thing is that it makes Admiral Sati go all Trigglypuff. And Trigglypuff is this person that is, you know, was one of these social justice warriors.
It's what happens to Bunny.
That's right. It's what happens to Bunny when
Trigglypuff meaning.
So it's a
great name.
It's an internet meme, and specifically, it's an internet meme. There was some this.
But what is Trigglypuff? I'm gonna
explain. So there's this social justice warrior, and she's a great big fat person, and you know,
great big fat person.
Was she that great big fat girl?
Put the lotion on the tongue.
And she's at Hampshire College, and they're trying to do some sort of, they're trying to have intellectual debate and have some discourse and whatever it may be. And there's this, somebody captured this video of this woman, and she's sitting there, and she just keeps going, "That's racism! That's racism! You can't da da." And the internet, in the wisdom of crowds, because the wisdom of crowds exists.
Yeah.
You don't have to create the wisdom of crowds. You just have to spark it.
Yeah.
And so the internet, in its wisdom of crowds, has figured out Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky's Thinking Fast and Slow. And specifically, there's this great video online, but you have to know to look for it, where it says, it shows her, and she like freaks out, her arms jiggle, right? And then it says, computing response. And what happens is that, of course, it takes her no time to respond. She doesn't have to compute a response because she doesn't engage in slow thinking. It's all fast thinking.
Yes.
So what ends up happening is that in the same way, Captain Picard creates conflict in Admiral Sati's mind because she loves her father, and then he is quoting her father's own words at her, and he's not saying, "You're not living this." But it becomes very clear that her actions do not fit her father's principles. She has lost her way.
Yeah.
And then she triggles. She goes all Trigglypuff.
Yeah.
And you can watch it. And specifically, that human behavior is right there. You watch, you know, it's on YouTube.
But I think prototypes also, see, I always like to look at it as there seems to be almost a predisposed programming. Mm-hmm. There seems to be sort of a common humanity. So story really brings people together under the umbrella of a common humanity. There's something about human beings mm-hmm. that resonates with beautiful music and beautiful mm-hmm. art and beauty in general
mm-hmm.
And great story that all people laugh and cry many times at essentially the same prototypes, the same kind of story.
But
right,
Brian,
so there is this nostalgia inside human beings to almost become one with those kinds of prototypes. So it's almost like Plato's Forms. Human beings have the imagination and the ability to imagine perfection, imagine mm-hmm. themselves being much better than they are, and know that they should be better than they are. Human beings have this very deep understanding that they're especially as you get older and you start to think, you have this sense that a great deal of how you live is dishonest. That you are probably in many ways a fraud, or at least that you could be a lot better, mm-hmm. and you should be better. And you even talk a lot of times like you are better. You'll tell people you do certain things, but you don't really do them, right?
You don't live your nagging, own principles.
Right,
yeah,
that nagging will ultimately get you to reach and get closer to your idea of perfection.
You follow your gut.
Yeah.
And so
that, to me, whether that's evolutionary or not...
Oh, no, Brian. Let's go here.
Because for me, I've never seen evidence that would be evolutionary.
Oh, but Brian,
This is where religion comes from.
This is where we're really going to have some amazing idea sex today.
Yeah.
Okay. So there's something that we have in common. Mm. And one of the things that we have in common is that we're terrible at self-promotion.
We're
literally the worst at self-promotion.
Yes, yes.
There's no doubt about that.
Yeah.
And anybody who has been watching, Katie O'Brien, also terrible at self-promotion.
Yeah.
Mike Horton, terrible at self-promotion. Shai Steinberger, quite good at self-promotion.
Yeah. Good for him.
But there are people who are like really just sell themselves.
Yeah.
And there are people who don't feel comfortable selling themselves.
Yes.
And, if you look at, for example, what's been happening, there's that the journey of the Brian Callen Show, because it has been a journey, has involved a lot of slow thinking. There are these slow hunches, and there are things that bug us that don't quite add up, and we're trying to navigate this space and figure out this space and all that sort of stuff. And along the way, people are listening. There are people with whom this message resonates, mm-hmm. right? It hits them emotionally. And they're like, this is great, this is great. You guys need to promote yourself more. You need to promote yourself more. You need to promote yourself. And we're like, it doesn't quite fit, and it doesn't quite add up. And we had one of the most interesting things that I think came out of the John Durant conversation is we were talking about Cincinnatus. Mm-hmm. And you said there don't seem to be a lot of Cincinnatuses around now. Mm. And so the question is, what is the difference between a Cincinnatus and a tyrant? There's a difference. Those are two archetypes. And they recur again.
Well, my definition would be a tyrant is essentially using power to better themselves.
Ah.
And Cincinnatus is using power to better the common good.
That's right. And he doesn't want power.
Yeah.
But at a certain point, he comes to realize that there is a crisis mm-hmm. and that he has a responsibility to step into power
yes.
and that he will take power until the situation is resolved, and then he will release power back to the people because it's a public trust.
Yeah.
So again, we're seeing there's these different psychologies.
Mm-hmm.
Now, let's talk about, I've watched your stand-up for years. And again, I've emotionally resonated with your stand-up for years. And somebody mm-hmm. tweeted to me, and he said, I really love how even though you've known Brian Callen since literally the day you were born, that he can make you laugh like a schoolgirl.
Mm.
You know, like a bunny, one might say.
Like a fucking bunny.
And so the question is, there's obviously, again, there are patterns in your stand-up comedy. There are things you're trying to figure out. And one of those big things is your father,
mm-hmm.
Big Mike.
Mm-hmm.
And you have a great story that you tell about Big Mike. And, let's look at the things that you do.
Mm-hmm.
There's Big Mike the character, and there's Michael Callen the man.
Right.
And those two things are not the same.
Mm-hmm.
You've taken Michael Callen the man, and you've exaggerated certain
features. I've created a prototype.
You've created a prototype.
Yeah.
Now, but one of the great stories that you tell about Big Mike is about Big Mike meets some friend of yours, and in 3 seconds, he's able to figure out who he is.
Yeah, guy comes in and goes, hey, Brian, how you doing? And I'll walk your dog. My dad said, what's that guy do? I said, he's a writer. He said, I suspect that's not going to work out for him. I say, how did you know that so quickly? He said, pattern recognition.
So pattern recognition. Now, is Big Mike, what's Big Mike's experience with science? How much science has Big Mike done?
Oh, well, he's read a lot about science, I think.
Yeah,
he's not done any primary scientific research.
No.
And still,
in spite of that, he's able to spot patterns.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps even that's what the human mind does.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe even man has a search for meaning. And that as long as we're presented with evidence, then we find the patterns. And maybe the job of a teacher is to create conflict in your mind, to put two things up against each other that don't quite fit, mm-hmm. and force you to create kintsugi. Mm-hmm. And maybe if you
putting gold around the broken
that's
pieces.
Right, and figuring out how it all fits together. And maybe if you live in a Western culture which overly favors atomism, you just don't get the chance to make kintsugi. You're constantly being presented with all these scattered pieces, and no one is ever putting them together and saying, you are going to have cognitive dissonance.
Yeah. You do create kintsugi, you have a little something called wisdom.
Oh, shit.
See that? See, you see how I bring it all back together?
But that's the whole point. That's what making kintsugi is about. And what we're doing with mixed mental arts, which again, this is an evolving art form, we're mm-hmm. figuring out how to do this, is we're helping people make kintsugi for themselves. We can't make kintsugi for you. Yeah. We can't create kintsugi. All we can do is put broken pieces next to each other, and then it's up to you to embrace that cognitive dissonance, to embrace the fact that things don't add up, they don't fit, they don't make sense, and then you have to figure out how to reconcile them. Mm-hmm. Now, that's not what fundamentalists do.
Well, we started out talking about, in this section, prototypes.
Oh, so now you really want to make kintsugi?
Yeah.
Yeah, you want to make some kintsugi?
Well, I don't know if I need to, but I do know
you do, Brian.
I do know as Jordan Peterson said, science is truth, and there's a great deal of truth, but it's not the only truth.
Oh, no, but
there
Brian,
are other truths, right?
Brian, let's make some real kintsugi here. Mm. Are you ready?
Mm-hmm.
So, what is the... Let's talk about fundamentalist Christians, yeah. as opposed to Jesus.
Right.
Okay. So, you know, people have, especially people who don't like religion very much, have very conflicted feelings about Jesus. But there's Jesus the man. What do you think Jesus was like? Was he a humble man?
Well, I think he was a rabbi, and I think he was humble, but I think he certainly was also a radical. He was also somebody who was an original thinker who mm-hmm. said that this orthodoxy, Leviticus, and all the hoops I got to jump through to be a good Jew can be simplified.
That's right. You know? And he didn't, to be clear, Jesus didn't invent any of the things that he said.
No.
My, you know, good friend Shai DeRuzel, mm-hmm. who has shared with me many of the things that are in the Talmud, he refers to Jesus as Yeshua, the false prophet.
Yeah. Get him on the podcast.
Yeah. Shai's great. Yeah. I'd actually, that's part of what's happened as well is, part of what I've realized is that you know, we have a fame culture, right? Mm-hmm. And so there's a focus on powerful people.
Yeah.
And so there's a desire to get powerful people on. And that's what we've been doing is we've been trying to get powerful academics on.
Right.
But you have someone like, for example, Peter Schiff, who has a lot of social power. But Peter Schiff is why our society is the way it is. He's a powerful person who is a fool.
Yeah.
And so he spreads foolishness.
Yeah.
So there's actually, I think we're going to make more progress.
He's a radical.
That's right. And so I think we're going to make more progress if we're getting on the people who emotionally resonate with our message from all over the world. And all it's very interesting because I did this thing at Second City where I went and spoke to them basically about all this research and just sort of broke it down as much as I could. And I was, you know, had sort of been forming these ideas already that the key is to, you know, live people's own principles more. You yes and their principles. You say, you know what, whatever it is that you believe in capitalism, you believe in Christianity, you believe in science, I yes and that. That's awesome. Let's do that more than we're already doing it.
What do you mean?
Well, so here's a great example. I've told the story before of Don't Mess with Texas, mm-hmm. right? So just to briefly break that down again, Don't Mess with Texas was a famous, they had this big problem with littering in Texas in the 70s and 80s and all of that stuff. And see, I just did it again. but I caught myself.
Right.
That, by the way, is the Hunter Motz drinking game. Every time I say one of these verbal tics, you're supposed to take a shot.
All that sort of stuff?
All that sort of stuff, right, you know.
Yep.
And if you're not wasted within like 5 minutes of anything that I'm talking about, you're not playing the game,
exactly,
guys.
Exactly.
So they hired this advertising company. And the advertising company, they sat around, and they did a lot of slow thinking, and they tried to figure out, how do you sell not littering to Bubba's and pickup trucks. Mm-hmm. And the solution they came up with is that you appeal to their Texas pride. And you take it, rather than keep America beautiful, you make it don't mess with Texas. And then they put, and you know, they went in and they talked to the Blue Hairs, who ran the Texas Department of Transportation, who were from a different culture, and they said, it's don't mess with Texas. And the Blue Hairs said, can we say don't mess with Texas, please? And they were like, no, ma'am, you cannot, because that would ruin the – it wouldn't be culturally appropriate
right.
then.
That's
it wouldn't
right.
be the diffusion of innovations.
No, it's don't mess with Texas or else.
Or
is really
else.
What, is really what the – people will fill that in.
That's right.
That's
and
what it means.
And so those simple three words, don't mess with
don't
Texas.
Don't they have don't tread on me as well?
Oh, well, that's the old – that's actually from the 1776. It's from
okay.
the American Revolution.
Oh.
It's a rattlesnake.
Yeah.
But I don't know that it was – it wouldn't have been Texas because it's 1776.
Okay.
But that was one of the big things, and that recurs again and again
yeah.
through American history.
But don't mess with Texas.
Don't mess with Texas. And it reduced massively the amount of littering.
Because they had, they also had what, a sign of somebody throwing something out
no,
the window?
No, literally just don't mess with Texas. And what's brilliant about it.
And people stopped littering?
People stopped littering. Littering went down massively, like 75%.
That's so interesting because they had state pride or?
Exactly.
But did they associate don't mess with Texas with not littering?
Well, but here's the amazing, well, the slogan takes on a certain power and probably what happens, I mean, I don't know the full history.
Yeah.
But I think that here's the interesting thing is that they, what those guys did, which was really, really wise, is they realized that littering was not a problem of Texans. It was a problem of a certain subset of Texans, a very specific subculture. And then they thought about the values and beliefs of that subculture, mm-hmm. and then they figured out how
to work within that culture.
And how to essentially do to them what Picard does to Admiral Saati. Right, he takes their own principles and he throws it back at them.
Mm-hmm.
And the point is that then you end up with this cognitive dissonance, and probably conversations happen, and they're like, "Don't mess with Texas." What does that mean? Of course, don't mess with Texas. And then they're like, "Well, when you throw things out your window on the interstate, you're messing with Texas."
Yeah.
And then there's cognitive dissonance.
Yeah.
And so
interesting.
And so now I have to resolve those feelings.
Yeah.
And so one of two things have to give: either I keep littering, or I stop liking Texas.
Mm-hmm.
And turns out that most people will stop littering because they're Texas.
But you know,
pride.
I would piggyback on that too. Again,
mm-hmm.
I think that there is also something inside people that
mm-hmm.
knows even when they litter
mm-hmm.
that it's wrong. And they might even be doing it to exercise their own sovereignty.
Yep.
They might be doing it as a general fuck you
mm-hmm.
to the haves because they're a have not or whatever
mm-hmm.
it might be. There's again, you know, it goes back to that sort of the sort of moral sense I think people have inside of them.
Yep.
And a moral sense is sort of this you know, human beings are always running toward pleasure and away from pain, but not always. There's something deeper going on with humanity. There's something that does separate us. There is something that is, I guess, mystical in some
mm-hmm.
ways. I always like to look at it that way. There is something that's impossible to measure and hard to explain. It doesn't mean we won't eventually be able to measure it in some way, but the point is almost that you can't measure it. The point is that you have to feel it, or the point is that we all do feel it, and we all feel it commonly. We all, you know, it goes back to when you want to kill other people, it's very common. It's very rare that the other side says, let's go kill those humans. What they do is they say, let's go kill those roaches, those rats, those scumbags. So even the most atrocious crimes committed by everyone from the Japanese in Manchuria to the Nazis in Poland or whatever is not done against quote unquote human beings. It's done against rats and roaches.
So I think what you're saying
child eaters and all that.
So I think what you're saying, Brian, is that all cultures create myths about other cultures.
Yes, and I'm also saying that they create myths to justify their own the behavior that doesn't necessarily resonate with their innate and deep moral sense. And so that is where I start getting into that's where the new atheists lose me, because they don't tell those stories. That's where Lawrence Krauss and Richard Dawkins lose me, because mm-hmm. they're only telling one side of the story. They're only telling the side of the story that seems to fit what their idea of religion is. And they never really look at the usefulness, the other uses that religion.
So is it possible, let's imagine a person who grows up only in one culture and is only exposed to the myths of that culture. Mm-hmm. And let's imagine a culture that for hundreds of years has sort of had the monopoly on truth, a growing monopoly. It's increasingly become more and more and more powerful.
A growing monopoly, a real truth, or you're saying?
On social power. The social power, like if I was to go out there and when we wrote the Straight A Conspiracy, this was the problem that Katie and I were trying to solve. When we wrote the Straight A Conspiracy, we knew that in order to be taken even vaguely seriously about what we were saying, we had to speak in terms of science, because science is the great authority of our time.
Yes.
So what we did was we did what we had to do. We went around and we found all the science we could that basically proved our point, the point we were trying to make, the thing that we had already observed. We're like, okay, you guys want science to prove this very simple principle that you need to believe in yourself in order to succeed? We'll do it. And so we went through, and in the end, the Straight A Conspiracy is based on 7 different fields of psychology and neuroscience. That's how much it took. But along the way, there were things that bugged us, things that didn't add up, things that didn't fit, things that forced us to create Kintsugi. And one of those things that didn't fit was the fact that there was this culture in 1776 that had this very simple faith. And that simple faith was that...
You could teach yourself anything through books, right?
And we realized that was what we were trying to create. We were trying to return to that culture, that simple faith. We were trying to create a second enlightenment. And we were doing it in the terms, but we ran up against.
Yes, but you see now, when you have to be careful, because it's true that you can teach yourself a great deal, but books alone will not save you. The problem with books are very, very important. And so, and discourse is very important, mm-hmm. and being responsive to the evidence is very important. But again, you know, the books and knowledge and Kintsugi and changing your point of view and opening yourself up is not going to save you alone. This
nope.
is where faith, this is where, you know, moral sense, this is where the rudder of mythology, you know, the fixed mythologies, this is what Jordan Peterson's argument is.
Yep.
Or for that matter, Socrates' argument is that there needs to be at least a fixed faith, some notion that there is, and I'm going to get to this, that there are lines that must not be crossed, as in when Joseph McCarthy is talking about, I've got all the names, and what's his name, Joseph Welch said.
Yep.
Said, have you no decency, sir?
Mm-hmm.
There is, you have now crossed the line of decency. It's exactly like saying, I can kill, if I kill 20,000 people today, I'll save 20 million
yep.
a year from now. Not so fast.
Mm-hmm.
That's not for you to make. That mm-hmm. choice is not for you to make. We do make those choices.
Mm-hmm.
We do go to war because sometimes the consequences are dire, and I understand that. But it's like these resources, we don't have enough resources for people on feeding tubes, so let's kill them
mm-hmm.
and let's use those resources to teach gifted children in the ghetto. Well, rationally, biologically, mathematically, I can understand that making sense
mm-hmm.
on a graph. It's not a society I want to live in
mm-hmm.
because ultimately it's unethical. Ultimately it's immoral. Now you want to talk about immorality? I can't necessarily talk to you about morality if you're Lawrence Krauss. I can't. I can talk to you about morality, but I'm going to have to get into ethereal subjects. I'm going to have to get into things I can't prove, but I can feel.
But Brian, here's the great thing, is that fortunately you know Toto. And Toto / Bunny
yeah.
can pull back the curtain and give you all the tools you need to challenge Lawrence Krauss in the terms of his own culture,
yeah.
namely science.
Yeah.
And I think what you're rubbing up against here is that you don't feel qualified to challenge the Church of Science.
Well, what I would say to the Church of Science is I would parrot Jordan Peterson, and mm-hmm. I would say, your science may tell me why things are, but your science doesn't teach me how to behave in the world and why I should behave that way.
But Brian, I think that's the thing. There's the myth of science is part of what we're trying to unravel. Mm. So let's try and create some kintsugi here. I'm going to line some things up from throughout human history.
Right.
And then you're going to see if you can create kintsugi.
Okay.
So there's the spirit of 76. Right?
Spirit, important
the
word.
The spirit.
Yeah.
Right? It's almost like they're talking about an emotional climate that existed in 1776.
Yep.
A climate of respect, trust, openness.
And innovation, revolution.
But maybe.
True kintsugi. I mean, they solved the political problem.
But maybe, Brian, it was because they got the emotional climate right. And when the emotional climate is right, wisdom emerges from between people.
Which was the discipline of civility, which uh-huh. was the discipline of not falling into violence because your side is losing yeah. even when the stakes are serious. That's right.
Now let's talk about improv comedy, right? What is the secret to improv comedy?
Yes, and.
Yes, and.
Yeah.
The point is that people throw things at you, and what you do is that you create the right emotional climate by constantly building off each other, mm-hmm. right? I hand you something. That's what a great conversation is. I'm handing you things. You hand me things. And over time, we've gotten better. If you compare our first episodes and the episodes that we're having now, we're getting better and better at yes, and.
Mm-hmm.
And as that happens, people are resonating with it because they're spotting that there's something here.
Mm-hmm.
Something is going on over here that's not going on in the rest of the world. And emotionally, they want that thing. Mm-hmm. So what if we talk about now the Undoing Project? So Kahneman, Tversky revolutionized psychology. And Michael Lewis has a great book all about why rather than talking about what they did in psychology, it talked about the relationship between these two individuals.
Yeah.
And they were strangely drawn to each other. They felt that the other one had something that they needed. And even though they were petulant and argumentative with other human beings, with each other, all they did was laugh and talk, and they would disappear into a room and giggle like schoolgirls for hours. And through these long...
Like Bunny and Shy,
or like Mike and Hunter, or like you and me, or like mm-hmm. Katie O and I, and I'm sure you have other people that you have this relationship with, right? We even have that relationship with Michael Malice, even though we wouldn't necessarily agree with his political philosophy. But if Michael Malice and we continue that relationship, which I hope we do, then over time, we're all going to get wiser just by improving and riffing off of each other.
Mm-hmm.
So what if, Brian... The great secret to wisdom, which is all that science is supposed to provide, which is a greater understanding of the world, greater pattern recognition, is an emotional climate. And does that emotional climate exist in the establishment of science today, or does it not?
No, but I wonder if
but hold on. Say no, but hold on.
Yeah.
But what are you running up against there? What feeling? Let's talk about the
feeling. Well, I do think that a great deal comes out of conflict. I think good things come out of conflict. However,
but what kind of conflict?
Well, conflict that ultimately reaches a compromise.
And that's the point.
Yeah.
And that's what the founding fathers had, is that they had respect.
Great movies come out of the writer has a point of view, the director has a point of view, the actors have a point of view, they all clash, and something magical happens.
Why is Pixar such a great and successful company?
I don't know. I don't know how they're
organized. You should read Creativity, Inc.
Yeah.
But if you read Creativity, Inc. and you compare Creativity, Inc. to The Smartest Men in the Room, Enron, there's the opportunity. You read those books side by side, you can create kintsugi. Because what you will notice, if you focus on just sort of, degrees and all that bullshit, then that's one thing. But if you focus on the different emotional climates, then you will realize that there are two different types of family. And specifically, there's this great idea from Tolstoy, who again was not a scientist, but we would say was a wise man because he wrote great books.
Great writer.
And the opening line of
I would imagine one is a patriarchy and the other is one is run by a strong man, one is run by a big powerful patriarch, and the others are essentially a consensus based
yep.
Yeah, consensus-based.
There's a spirit at Pixar.
Almost a democracy.
Yeah, almost a democracy, yeah. Brian. That might be a different name.
And that would be no ideas. No ideas are better than, you know, the best idea wins, basically.
That's right.
But everybody gets a chance to fight for their idea, to voice their idea, and other people should listen and respect the process by which it takes to get the best idea out. Because a lot of times what happens, and I've been in rooms, creative rooms like Mad TV and things, where you are pitching an idea and people are making fun of you just loud enough for you to hear. And it creates a very dangerous environment.
That's right.
For people to, you know.
And if you talk to economists, again, because all we're doing is going around and going around to all these different tribes and picking up what they know. And if you go to the tribe of economists and you talk to, as we have, or I have, Luigi Zingales, you missed that episode, or you read Hernando de Soto's book, The Other Path, or you read Why Nations Fail, or you read any of these things, you understand that there is this sort of pattern, which is that the great secret is inclusivity. And that if you have an environment of trust and cooperation, and that's the big difference between somewhere like the, you know, the United States in 1776 and somewhere like Libya today. 1776 was Pixar. It was a high trust environment, and it's the same thing as an improv studio. Everybody's just riffing off of each other, and from that emerges creativity. There may be, you know, a movie like Inside Out, which let's look at Inside Out. Who is Inside Out is a great example of the kind of intellectual diversity that leads to greatness. Because they took a group of people who were fundamentally coming from very different places. Take Dacher Keltner, our buddy, Paul Ekman, who, you know, we are both fanboys of. And then you take a bunch of animators and directors and all that sort of stuff. You have people from the tribe of science and you have people from the tribe of, you know, creative people. But there's a respect there.
Yeah.
And there's a mutual respect.
Well, and that just specifically means everybody has something to contribute.
That's right. And when I interviewed Dacher Keltner most recently, he said this very interesting thing. And you can go back. Again, Toto doesn't tell people what to think. Toto lets people form his own conclusions.
That's right.
And, you know, if you go to the Dacher Keltner episode, there's this very interesting thing that Dacher says. And he says, you know, he feels that there's something that's changing and that more and more scientists are discovering this Christian spirit. Now, why does he use the word Christian? Because what he's doing is he's recognizing, because Dacher Keltner is a man on the path to wisdom, he's recognizing that actually this is something that's existed before. And that, for me, there was a great cognitive dissonance. And you have to understand that I think that one of the huge advantages that I've had in engaging with all this science, what has forced me to create Kintsugi much faster than maybe some other people, is that I had no authority. In the culture of science, I was the lowest of the low. You know, I only had a bachelor's degree. And, you know, to only have, I had a bachelor's degree, I had never published a paper. You know, I am like I'm almost like a little dog, like Toto. And, you know, Toto doesn't get to challenge the great wizard, right? The only way that Toto can, you know, defeat the wizard is just to pull back the curtain and let the people see for themselves what is there. And so because of that, what happened, and I didn't understand this at the time, but I understand it now, what happened was is that along the way, there was a lot of cognitive dissonance. Because I was sitting in this bizarre place known as the Beverly Hills Playhouse, a place that I only went to because a man that I respected, Brian Callen, told him, Motz, we're going to take care of you, because that's what Brian Callen does, is he makes everybody feel like a king, even when the person doesn't feel like a king about themselves. And because he wraps the right story around people and makes them feel awesome about themselves, they love him. And they can't help loving him.
They can't help it.
Yep. And so, you know, you told me I needed to go to the Beverly Hills Playhouse, and I did it. Why did I do it? Because there was some emotion that drove me there.
Yeah.
And so I went into the Beverly Hills Playhouse, and I sat in this environment of all these actors.
Yeah.
And not just actors, but Scientologists. Yeah. The Beverly Hills Playhouse was a hotbed of Scientology.
Sure was. Yeah.
And, you know, for me, you know, coming from Harvard and coming from science, cultures which did not respect acting and did not respect Scientology and did not respect emotions, all the things that I respected the least, that I had the most emotional judgment on, it was a very uncomfortable environment.
Yeah.
I didn't understand it at the time, but what was happening was a lot of cognitive dissonance. And at some point, the cognitive dissonance...
Explain cognitive dissonance for some of our
listeners. Things not adding up.
Yeah.
Now, it's an experience that we've all had. There are things... Why do... You know, you referenced at the beginning some person who said, you know, Hunter articulated what I've always been feeling.
Yeah.
So we all have this experience of things not adding up. Things don't quite make sense. And it takes people a long time to find the words to say what allows them to express how things add up.
Yeah.
I have been on a lifelong journey, you know, moving between all these cultures, things have not added up for a long, long time.
Yeah.
And one of the best lines that you've ever told me, which I absolutely adored, is that you've seen great suffering from inside an air-conditioned car.
Yes.
That is the experience, Citibank experience in a nutshell.
Yeah.
And if you happen to have parents who are compassionate and care, and maybe even have something called integrity, which is a rare, rare animal nowadays.
Yeah. My parents do, yeah.
Yeah. Then a lot of things bug you. You're constantly being bugged. And it's that feeling of having things bug you. There are things that aren't quite right.
It's also being given things. I was given everything for no reason.
Yep.
And some people were given nothing
for no reason.
And I was just chosen.
That's right. And you didn't like that.
No.
And I didn't like that.
Which is also why I don't self-promote.
That's right.
You know?
So the point is that these very sort of basic feelings that we have, and this is where it's going to get really uncomfortable for some of the new atheists, because what you're talking about is reciprocal altruism. The point is that the tribe is not fair. And if you are someone like my friend Piggy, Thomas Woods, and you've grown up in the United States, and you grew up in the world's greatest gated community, you might be foolish enough to think that the walls are a prison, and that the guard tower, that the guards are, you know, there to police you rather than to protect you.
Well, he's never been to Somalia.
That's real.
That's real libertarianism.
That's right.
That's anarchy. That's anarchy, Michael Malice.
That's right.
It really is.
Yep.
And what happens is gangs form.
That's right.
And the toughest guys who are willing to kill people start getting a monopoly on the violence. It's exactly what feudal Japan was, with all the shoguns and ronin ready to be hired at the shogun's whim to fight his turf battles.
So people with culturally diverse experiences are forced to make kintsugi. And what ends up happening is that they see people who promote things that make sense within the prejudices of their own culture, but don't make sense based on what we've experienced and what we've been through. It doesn't quite add up.
Mm-hmm.
And so then we're trying to suss out these people. How can these people think what they think? And so we have Thomas Woods on, and you know, people notice that there was a conflict, because in our interview with Thomas Woods, I was perfectly respectful. Because that's what I had been taught. I had been taught that there should be respectful discourse and that you should let everybody have their say and all opinions are equally valid.
Yeah, we used to do that all the time.
That's right. Yeah. And that's
And then when they would leave, we'd have you and I would talk about how the holes in that.
Mm-hmm.
We would start examining it from a distance and go, well, problem is if it's only 2% government, what's going to da 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 da? And,
yeah.
You know. Yeah.
And so, but.
And I used to do that. Just aligned myself with a team.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to say, I'm a libertarian.
Yep.
I'm a true libertarian. I used to like to say that. And the reason I would say that is because in my opinion, it felt right.
Mm-hmm.
It felt right because my father would talk that way.
Mm-hmm.
And also I figured that the arguments had already been won, had been thought out and won for me.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't really have to go into reading Free to Choose a second time with Milton Friedman or F.A. Hayek's A Road to Serfdom. I didn't really have to actually listen to everything. And actually, better, I didn't have to read and listen to the libertarians, the leaders of the libertarian thought, with a critical ear.
Yep.
And that was the biggest thing. That's the difference between wisdom. That's the difference between getting to a point where you don't have any reverence.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have any more reverence for the smart people at the Cato Institute, the quote-unquote smart people like Tom Woods and Michael Malice, all who are smart, all who have a great deal I don't like smart, but all who have something to contribute to the larger conversation, but that does not mean that they shouldn't be challenged. It doesn't mean they shouldn't be criticized. It doesn't mean they shouldn't be held accountable to their own fast thinking.
I think the reality is, well, we're becoming wiser here, Brian, because we're on the path.
But it's important.
But I just want to. I think it's important to clarify terminology, because that's a large part of what humanity is dealing with. Is that a lot of these words have become meaningless? Like a word like capitalism. Yeah. Capitalism for me, capitalism is what Adam Smith wrote in The Wealth of Nations and The Theory of Moral Sentiments, his two books. To understand capitalism, you have to read both books and you have to resolve the contradictions. And the contradictions are that in The Theory of Moral Sentiments, it's very clear that Adam Smith is an intuitionist. It's very clear that if you sat Adam Smith from 1776 down with Jonathan Haidt, they would be able to have a very productive conversation. And they would illuminate and reveal things in each other's thinking, and they would get what they were going on. But if you sat Adam Smith down with a lot of very powerful economists today, then I think Adam Smith would just say that they were fools because they're rationalists. And again, pattern recognition. What's interesting, again, and I think it's important to recognize...
Well, rationalists, meaning they're assuming that consumers and human beings behave rationally.
That's right. Yeah. And but crucially, I think what's interesting about pattern recognition is just as Big Mike is able to quickly suss out a situation, even though he's not a scientist, even though it's his ability to suss out patterns is from having traveled the world and met lots of people, and the fact that Big Mike fundamentally respects people who think differently from them and tries to understand them and is a very compassionate individual. What's interesting is that Big Mike is like John Haidt. We can put Big Mike, John Haidt next to each other, and we can try and make kintsugi, and we can try and figure out what's the same. How are they the same? And if you do that, you'll notice that John Haidt has great pattern recognition. Mm-hmm. Because John Haidt, in this interview with Sam Harris, he sits down with Sam Harris, and in 3 seconds, John Haidt is able to suss out that Sam Harris is a rationalist.
Where can we listen to that?
You can. That's Waking Up, Sam Harris's podcast, and his interview with John Haidt.
All right.
And there's two things that I want you to notice. Mm-hmm. Is that there's a disagreement between John Haidt and Sam Harris on two issues. One, and these are the two issues that I brought up in the Joe Rogan podcast. And one is rationalism versus intuitionism, and two is multi-level selection. And I think a great place to end this is this. I want to teach the controversy. Now, it's important to realize that when you teach the controversy, it's not that everybody is going to instantly understand things. When I taught at Oaks Christian, because I taught the controversy around evolution there, it wasn't that my students instantly understood. It took a long time to unpack things, earn their trust, do all these sorts of things, so that people could understand everything that was being said. But I have such faith in science. My faith in science is so profound that I believe the facts speak for themselves, that the evidence will carry the day as long as it is turned over in the light and as long as the broad mass of the people are allowed to see it. Toto believes that if you pull back...
Bunny.
Toto, Bunny.
A.K.A. Bunny. A.K.A. Hunter Moss.
Yeah, A.K.A. So... I believe that if you pull back the curtain that on the wizards, that two things are going to happen. One, that you will see who they are as a person, what is really going on emotionally mm-hmm. inside with them, and I think you will see them triggle. I think they will be revealed for Triggly Puffs. So that's my first hypothesis, which we can test.
Okay.
And then my second hypothesis is that suddenly... people will start to think very differently about their own potential. And I think that what you're going to do is you're going to smell something in the air. And it's going to be the same thing that was in the air with
in 1776. And that is the spirit that you can learn anything.
And it's the, but I think it's the point is it's a spirit that has appeared again and again throughout history. It's the same spirit that, and I don't know because
the
I wasn't there.
Of discovery.
I think it was the same spirit that was in that upstairs room when Jesus was surrounded by 12 disciples. Mm. And I think it's the same spirit that happens, you know, when you have, that's in Pixar. Yeah. And I think it's a spirit that you can find all over the world in every time and mm-hmm. in every place mm-hmm. and that it's taken a long, long time for humanity to figure out the secret of our success. Mm. But fortunately, I think that all the pieces are now there to make the most beautiful kintsugi that there has ever been.
Mm. Hunter Motz, man.
Yep.
Hunter got emotional when he said that shit, too.
That's another thing. Again, you guys told me that you wanted me to get more emotional. I said I would cry on the next podcast. I didn't plan this out. I'm just making this shit up as I go
Hunter
along.
Hunter literally has tears in his eyes.
I literally have tears in my eyes.
I'm not kidding. That's a beautiful That was beautiful. I feel like saying amen, but
say amen, Brian.
It'd be a little too religious.
No, it is. But praise science. Praise science. Hallelujah.
Yeah.
I want to spread the glorious gospel of science. And, you know, I believe currently Richard Dawkins and Sam Harris and all the new atheists are Scientologists. Mm. They're not, what they're promoting is not science. They haven't felt the glorious gospel that is science. Mm. And you have to understand that this is a big problem in evolution, mimicry. You know, there's the coral snake, you know, and then there are other types of snake that try and imitate the coral snake. One is venomous. One just has the same markings, but actually has no venom.
God damn, I like that.
Or, you know, you can talk about turkey and tofurkey, right?
Yep.
There, you know, vegans will constantly tell us.
See, that tastes just like turkey.
Turkey, but they're vegans.
But carnivores are going to be like, get the
fuck out of
it.
Here. And so what I'm telling you is I've tasted science. Mm. I have tasted turkey, and I feel like Richard Dawkins and Sam Harris are two vegans trying to sell the world on the fact that tofurkey is science. And it is not. It is not turkey. It's Scientology.
We're going to get Sam Harris on the podcast.
We have created the controversy. Now we're going to teach the controversy.
Yes!
Hallelujah!
Ladies and gentlemen,
praise science!
Another awesome episode of Mixed Mental Arts. God bless. And be responsive to the evidence.
Kintsugi.
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show with Brian Callen. Be sure to like him on Facebook. Just search for Brian Callen Comedy. And follow him on Twitter. Just search for @BrianCallen. You can also find him online by visiting his website. Just go to briancallen.com. Until next time, bye-bye.